think we're the last frontier? Well, guess what? It's moved on. Or maybe not. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Americans are doing less hunting, less fishing. They never got interested. They were too busy watching TV when they were kids. Their parents made them fear the outside. Nature deficit disorder is the subject today. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, toll free. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Richard Louvre is our guest on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service just put out their 2006 National Survey of Fishing, Hunting, and Wildlife-Associated Recreation, and it shows that there is a 6% increase in wildlife-related recreation. But guess what? The numbers of hunters and anglers fell from 37.8 million in 2001 to 33.9 million in 2006. And there was an 8% increase in the number of wildlife watchers since 2001, which made up the difference. We're going to get into this subject of getting kids outside, and it's a pleasure to me to introduce this subject. We'll start with the summit that is coming up in Anchorage, the Get Outdoors Anchorage Summit. With us is the Deputy Director of the Anchorage Parks and Recreation Department, Beth Nordland. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Beth.
Good morning, Steve.
So what is this summit aiming to do?
We are looking for an Anchorage solution to getting kids and people outside. We are finding that there's an entire generation of youth that are disconnected from the natural world, and that brings a lot of community problems with it. So all kinds of federal agencies are getting together with the mayor and the city and the state and trying to take a look at some Anchorage solutions to the issue.
So you're bringing together then all these agencies, entities, and people.
It's a lot of policymakers.
Yeah, and they spend like, what, a day, 2 days?
2 days collaborating, networking, trying to see what we can do together because I can tell you, Anchorage Parks and Recreation isn't going to solve the problem by itself.
No, but the parks would seem to be an important part of the strategy.
Right. We have 223 municipal parks inside the bowl, 250 miles of trail, a lot of assets we can use to get people outside.
There are probably some listeners who are already acquainted with the name Richard Louvre. He joins us today from his home in San Diego, where he's working on another book. But the book we're going to be talking about is Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Richard, I guess you're the first one to say that you just sort of made up that name, Nature Deficit Disorder.
Right. And I'm very careful in the book to, say that this is not a known medical disorder. It is, however, a handy way to describe what a lot of us have been seeing and noticing and perhaps even sensing in the back of our mind, but didn't really have a language to describe, which is this growing disconnect between children and nature and the implications of that.
You know, Beth and I, basically I'm of an age to be early in the boomers, and Beth here was graduating high school in 89, right?
88.
So we basically have that gap illustrated just between the two of us where we're realizing I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. There was woods all around, and we spent all our time outside, and I knew just what you were saying when you talked about catching crawdads. And how your son had no idea what you were talking about. And Beth here grew up in Juneau, Alaska. And what you were telling me, right? You just didn't get outdoors much.
It was raining the whole childhood. It didn't stop me from growing up to be an environmentalist. But I didn't spend my entire childhood outside in nature, no.
And this kind of illustrates something that you speak of, I think, Richard, about the generational difference that she has built an intellectual relationship that I wouldn't have, and that is really different, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is, and it has its own value. I mean, it's a good thing that young people, including Beth, today have actually a lot more knowledge than people my age. I'm a baby boomer. About some of the details, some of the science of the environment, of ecology, of global warming, of many of the larger environmental issues. Certainly, I had no clue that my woods that I played in were connected to any other woods ecologically. The difference is those were my woods. I owned those woods. To the extent that I pulled out, I think, hundreds of survey stakes that had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods. That sense of ownership as a kid, that sense of belonging to nature and having nature belong to you, having a personal connection to it, that is the thing that is in danger of being lost. Now, it's true that there is more intellectual knowledge. Kids have Animal Planet. They have lots of information about nature. What they don't know, though, is the names of the plants and animals in their own backyard often. They don't know about their own region. They know about nature as an abstraction and about and in terms of scientific details that are more global in nature. So that's the change. It's almost a reverse polarity in the relationship between children and nature. They can tell you anything about the Amazon rainforest. They can likely not tell you very much about the last time they went outside and just watched the leaves move.
Richard, where is the urgency? Why have people become so enthusiastic about your book?
Well, I think that there is a kind of an innate instinctual understanding that personal relationship with nature is important. That, you know, this just in terms of whether or not we care about the environment deeply at some deep level, not just an intellectualized level, but at some deep level. The studies show that almost to a person, conservationists, people who identify themselves as people who have an environmental consciousness, almost always had some personal relationship with nature when they were kids. They had direct experience in nature when they were kids. What happens if that changes? I would bet that Beth has a lot of interaction with nature now and knows nature now, partly because of your work, Beth. But without that personal relationship with nature, where will the future stewards of the Earth come from? Again, there will always be conservationists, but increasingly they will carry nature in their briefcases and not in their hearts, and that's a very different and, I believe, less sustainable relationship. The other thing, too, is that I think people, again, almost instinctively understand that engagement in nature is profoundly good for child development. Now we have a body of evidence, of scientific evidence, that's emerged in the last dozen years or so, primarily, that shows just how great nature is for kids, for attention deficit disorder, for those symptoms, for certainly for obesity among children, for cognitive development, for creativity. There's a whole emerging amount of evidence that shows just how important that is.
And I guess you take something, for instance, like obesity, and there is going to be a health cost later on. You know, whether it's diabetes or something else, it's just that basically we will see costs from this sort of sedentary lifestyle, yes?
You bet. And yeah. In fact, just a few weeks ago, there was a study that was released. I think it was the University of Washington and University of Indiana and Purdue that really for the first time, there's always been indirect evidence that you know, a city that has a lot of green in it, a lot of outdoor availability of nature, nearby nature within cities, that there's been indirect evidence that had something to do with child obesity. But this new study shows for the first time direct evidence that cities that have a lot of nearby nature, right in the city, right in your own neighborhood. Those neighborhoods, the kids do not suffer from as much child obesity as in cities where they do not have access to that kind of nearby nature.
Well, bearing in mind that, we're talking Alaska, and we're talking a city that basically has a lot of fallow space still inside of it, although it's infilling rapidly. What will be your advice to Beth as a park manager for how best to run the parks to provide the opportunity for engagement with nature by the youth in our community?
Well, first, that would be presumptuous to give Beth advice about that. I'm interested in her advice about how to connect kids to nature. I do think that the kind of importance of parks is going to increase, particularly the parks that are nearby. The gas prices are down again now a little bit, but they're going to go back up. This isn't going to last. And I recently did an essay in which I borrowed and gave credit for a headline from Outside Magazine, which was "Near is the New Far." That increasingly, I think that the nearby parks are going to be important for connecting people to nature, as opposed to the ones that you drive, hundreds of miles to. That means that to rethink the way we do urban development, et cetera, and the value we place on urban parks. Certainly, it's true in Alaska. You've got a lot of open space. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, in Kansas, which is one of the cities in the lower 48 that is the least dense. I mean, there's a lot of open space in Kansas City, and I played in those woods a lot. But just because the woods are right there doesn't mean that kids will go into them. That's one of the odd things about this phenomenon. It is in rural areas, child obesity is growing at about twice the rate that it is in urban areas in America, that the access to woods is only to nature is only part of the equation. Will kids actually go out there and use it? That's another question.
There's a chilling episode in your book. I considered it chilling. It started out so great that these kids were just kind of let loose and realized that they could go out there, they could play ball, basically parents said, "You just try it." They could run around, they could play ball, they could climb trees, they could find little streams to mess around in and so forth. And sure enough, the kids, they had trouble getting them back in the house. But what was so chilling was, next day, it was suggested, "Well, don't you want to go out and do some more stuff out there?" And the kids said, "No, we already did that."
Yeah.
So
that's actually an example from Kansas City, from a neighborhood near where I grew up when I was a kid.
Yeah, and so what's going on there would seem to be that it takes a dialogue. You can't just go out and experience it like an amusement park. There has to be a dialogue that takes place.
That's right, and it has to take place over time. That the programs that get, for instance, inner-city kids out into nature, it's great for those kids. I mean, it's wonderful for them to have that experience, but one time doesn't change their lives usually. Some kids it might, but most of the time you need repetitive experiences. It has to be in the culture. I mean, we need cultural change, not just more programs, I think, is ultimately what we're talking about. The culture has been sending messages to kids and to parents for at least 30 years now that nature's in the past, probably doesn't matter anymore. The future is in electronics. The boogeyman lives in the woods, and nature and going outside and playing in nature is possibly illicit and possibly even illegal. And I'll give examples of that later in our discussion. But the whole idea of the criminalization of natural play. Now, this is probably not happening in most of Alaska, but certainly in San Diego where I live. Just look at the rules and regulations that govern almost all of the housing developments in the United States built in the last 35 years. Just try to put up a basketball hoop in some of those neighborhoods, let alone let the kids build a four-year treehouse. It's against the rules. So the kids learn that. They hear that message, and we're giving them that message in a variety of ways. Even schools give them that message. So it's no surprise You know, I don't use pejorative terms like couch potatoes when I talk about kids who are sitting on the couch watching TV and playing video games, because I think those kids are following cultural orders. They're being good kids. We have to ask ourselves what kind of messages, whether it's the news media or schools or parents or, you know, the entertainment media, et cetera, what kind of messages are we sending, including the very structure of the neighborhoods we live in, the legal structure, the litigation, the fear of litigation, fear of strangers? What kind of messages are we sending kids about the value of nature?
And sometimes it can be dangerous. I mean, I'm thinking, Beth, and you would know more about this than me, but some years ago in Anchorage, they decided that the swing sets and so forth had to have this padding underneath them. And then about 2 years ago, the kids discovered that padding really burns really nice, and they started going burning this stuff.
It's flammable.
That's a great story.
Yeah, well, but it's just plain crazy, and because it's sort of a never-ending spiral of, you know, yes, it's dangerous, and yes, now it's dangerous in a different way. She didn't want me talking about that, I could tell.
We have 82 playgrounds in our parks, and it's a lot to take care of. But what Richard is talking about, we're putting a lot of effort into structured play. You know, we've got amazing opportunities for people to get out there and participate in Tuesday night races and the skates at Westchester Lagoon. I'm really interested to find out how our community can talk about unstructured play, time outside, that helps your creativity and your social skills and your self-esteem and your academic performance and, you know, attention deficit disorder and all those kind of things in an unstructured way, connecting us to the natural world.
Yeah, Richard, I'll get back to you in a second, but I want to go ahead and break for a call here with Carol, who joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carol.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wanting to get this kind of local. In Ketchikan, we have this school, and right next to the school is this fabulous trail that runs from the school down through all kinds of terrain in the forest to the most fabulous beach and a beautiful and really educational experience that over the years the teachers and people in that neighborhood have kind of developed this as an educational experience. That they work into their curriculum to some extent at the school, but it's just such a wonderful opportunity to have people, when they go into the forest and they have an experience, if it's an educational experience, then they feel more comfortable the next time they go out, and they have some reason, and it's interesting, and they know that it's not just a one-dimensional, one-time experience, and they are more comfortable in being outdoors. And
so, you're saying that the structure can lead to the unstructured if you have the opportunity.
Well, see, here's the issue. The land has been given to the Mental Health Land Trust. And so the school can go there, but there has to be all these agreements between the borough and the school district and the, you know, and the land is actually in the Mental Health Land Trust.
I see.
It seems to me that when we set up these institutions like the Mental Health Land Trust, and those lands go into the public trust, that the public needs to have some voice in this to say, hey, you know, this is an opportunity for us to deal with these children that have attention deficit disorders, because I think that's one of the reasons why we have such a large dropout rate, is because some kids just can't be inside all the time, or they can't be in that structured environment all the time.
Yeah, Carol, you're preaching to the choir on that, but you and I both know that the reason the Mental Health Land Trust was created was to generate income that would then go to mental health programs. Now you're saying, well, this land is a mental health program.
I'm saying that it needs to be recognized as a mental health resource. And that we need to stop looking at these land trusts that we're setting up as just economic engines. because it's if you put your money and your resources into education that will pay off for you in the long run, then you've made money. Or if you've got a situation where, I mean, because I know that part of the Mental Health Land Trust money is supposed to go into providing housing for special needs and stuff like that, and that's important. But it also needs to expand into providing for the education of people with special needs.
Yes, and prevention is definitely part of what they put money into.
And this is
a form of it's very intriguing, Carol. Very well-rounded thought there.
It's not just it's not just prevention. It is having that people with different abilities be accepted and find their niche, because you can't say, you know, unless you can sit inside all day and stare at a screen, you have no value. You know, if you want to be out in the woods and those kinds of things are more interesting to you and it adds dimension to your life, then those things should be equally supported.
Carol, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
All right. Carol from Ketchikan. Our guests are Richard Louv, the author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, and Beth Nordland, Deputy Director of Anchorage Parks and Recreation. Is it a department, division, office?
It's a department.
All right. You're a department. Let's go. Which has how many parks?
223.
All right, and she's one of the major participants in this summit that is going on, which is really just Anchorage specific. But we thought it made for a statewide subject, this whole issue of our youngsters and their contact with nature. Let's go now to Mike. Joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mike.
Yeah, I like what that caller from Ketchikan said. That was some good stuff. And yeah. I'm a former crawdad catcher myself, but I'm really excited about Democratic Senate, especially with the two Udall guys from New Mexico and Colorado, because the bills that really got America out, in my mind, more than anything, was the Robertson-Pittman and the Dingell Johnson, because, you know, those were tax bills that built up the game herds. And so I'm excited about that. And then I'm also hoping that we'll have some more pro-environment type of energy stuff, as opposed to what we had in the last 8 years, where we had tax deductions available for people that bought Hummers. I had a stepson down in California that even got a deduction to buy it. It had to be a big vehicle. It couldn't just be a regular vehicle.
Oh, wow.
If you look outside your station right now, what you're going to see is a lot of people driving around in cars, and Anchorage has an excellent trail system for bikes. I've used it a lot when I've been up there. You can get places in Anchorage on the bike system sometimes faster than you can by car, because the trails run the river valleys, and they're more direct in some cases.
Sometimes.
So I'm just excited about a different direction, and that Americans will be more drawn to a sense of place more than just chasing a dollar and I'm just looking forward to everything, and I hope that we'll have some pro land use legislation that'll really help the common people get out and enjoy things.
Mike, thanks for your call.
You bet.
Yeah, Richard Louv, maybe you could talk a little bit about the sense of place business, because I think this goes to this business of knowing nature in an abstract way as opposed to knowing nature in a very specific dialogue fashion.
Well, we only love what we know. And I think that is kind of at the root of this, is that we need to know the places we live. We need to know the nature around us, not just as something in a textbook, whether it's talking about, extraction of resources or global warming. Those are larger issues that are not the kinds of issues that make us at an early age love nature and love where we're at. This is also connected to our sense of community, even if democracy, that you know, believe it or not, it takes going outside to know your neighborhood, outside the front door. That if more and more kids are staying indoors and not having an outdoor experience, even in their own neighborhood, let alone in nature, then you're not going to be building community in the long run. As far as, you know, the caller just mentioned the need for, you know, political interest in this. Just a few months ago, about 2 months ago, actually I think it was in September, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the No Child Left Inside Act. And what that act would do if it progresses in the Senate, and it will probably change into something else in the Senate, but the purpose of the act is to send more money to the states to use in environmental education and get kids outside the classroom, hopefully. As that progresses in the Senate, I'm hoping that the idea of what a classroom is questioned and thought about in a wider sense, that parks can be classrooms, farms and ranches can be classrooms. In Norway right now, educators and farmers are working together to come up with curricula so that kids spend some of their time in a classroom, but some of their time also on a farm where they learn about nature and they learn about agriculture and so forth. That's a hopeful direction. The caller before, though, said a couple of real interesting things about, first, the idea that can structured play lead to an experience in nature. And as Beth talked about, the ultimate goal here is unstructured play in nature. But structured play, if it's in a progression, if a program, for instance, has this in mind as kind of the goal, then they can take kids in a structured education setting. And over time, every experience that progresses can be a little less structured. And they actually can really emphasize to kids and train kids in a way to have unstructured experiences in nature that are just fun, just there for the fun of it, not necessarily for the information, but for the experience. The second thing that the caller talked about is the Association of Land and Mental Health, or health in general. Howard Frumkin is the head of the Center for Environmental Health for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. He's one of the most important people in the world in terms of public health. Howard is a physician. He and I wrote an essay that's available at the Children and Nature Network website, which is childrenandnature.org, about this issue. And Howard did the heavy lifting of writing the piece. But essentially what it says is that we now know enough about the impact of natural spaces on health, on mental health as well as physical health, that we can now view the availability of natural spaces in urban areas as a public health issue. And this is enormously important. In England, they're ahead of us on this. There's the largest mental health charity, or the health charity in England, is called MIND, M-I-N-D. And in the UK, just last year, they came out with a major report saying that we can only go down the road of pharmaceuticals so far, particularly in terms of mental health. We can only hand out so much Ritalin. We can only hand out so many antidepressants before we come to the conclusion that we have to go to other avenues as well, including nature therapy. They came out with a report saying nature therapy has to be part of our overall strategy for mental health. And that's one of the reasons why the parks are so important.
Oh, wow. You've just given me a head full. We're talking to Richard Louv. He's the author of Last Child in the Woods. And as he mentioned, he has a website, www.childrenandnature.org. Two of the board members of the network are featured during this summit we're having in Anchorage called the Get Outdoors Anchorage Summit. And they'll be giving keynote speeches down at the Denina Convention Center as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Working late? Hear Alaska news nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Well, it's time to put out the email address, talk@APRN.org, because the comments are already coming in, and there are a ton of calls for the show, and we only got a half hour left. Our guests are Beth Nordland and Richard Louvre, and Abigail weighs in from Fairbanks, where actually maybe this is the same Abigail. Is that you that sent the email, Abigail?
Yes.
Okay, well, go right ahead and tell us then.
Okay, well, I read Mr. Louvre's book, and I thought it was very inspiring. I'm the vice president of the Watershed School Academic Policy Committee. And the Watershed School is a new K-8 charter school, which is set to open in Fairbanks in fall 2009. Our program is based on the philosophy that it benefits students to learn outdoors, developing a hands-on relationship with nature. The theme of our school will be place-based education, which is a philosophy that involves developing connections between students and their local landscape and community. And I think this school will be a way for students in our valley to take advantage of the unique characteristics here and become connected and knowledgeable about their home place.
All right. So you got a program then is starting next year?
Yeah, in the fall.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. The state just approved it last week.
All right. Well, congratulations double. We always like to make news on this show. Even if it's a little bit of news. You know, Richard, I think our next... Thank you, Abigail, for your call.
You're welcome.
We'll go to George, who joins the program from Anchorage now. I think you'll find this one of interest, Richard. George, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Howdy, Richard. Yeah, my name's George, and one of the things that has bothered me for quite a while is how it seems like there's fewer and fewer people who are going out in the woods because they're afraid of getting attacked by a bear or dying in an avalanche or, you know, getting lost and whatever. And yet, when you look at the statistics, the number of people who go out in the woods is really high compared to the number of people who might get attacked by a bear in Alaska. Excuse me, in Alaska. And, you know, when you compare that with the statistics of people who go in small aircraft and crash and die, or go out on their snow machines and get, you know, die of hypothermia or whatever, it's quite low. And it seems to me, though, that there's kind of this preoccupation in the press about forest fear, you know, making people afraid to be out there. They go into great detail whenever there's a death due to somebody getting lost, or like the whole Christopher McCandless thing, or if somebody gets attacked by a bear, they go into great detail about that. And yet it's actually a very rare occurrence. And
All right, George, as a news person, I'm having a very hard time keeping my mouth shut on this one.
Go for it.
but I want to let Richard throw his thoughts in on this one here, because I think the outcome is exactly as you say. But, I mean, you know, for us, from our point of view, it's simply not news when somebody goes in the woods and nothing happens. No matter how many times it happens, it continues to not be news. It's only news when there's something unusual that happens, you know.
I guess my concern is that if somebody dies in an aircraft accident, it's not, you know, it's not that big a deal. You know, they don't go into all the great detail, the suffering or the bones crunching or whatever, you know. But you definitely have, like, lots of follow-up about it. And this year has been a big bear year because the bears have been down low for some reason. So I noticed it even more. But just in general, that any small thing about where someone dies in the woods is much bigger than when someone dies in a car accident, or when someone dies, of, you know, because, I don't know. There's all kinds of things that
people die of. Yeah, no, I think it's a great observation. And Richard, I'm sure you've thought about this.
Yeah. And I'm a news person too. I mean, I spent 24 years as a newspaper columnist, so I understand what you're saying about, you know, the need to report things that seem unusual, that we're drawn to that. But I have to say that, you know, in Last Child in the Woods, I talk about fear as... perhaps the largest reason, the most intensely felt reason, at least,
that parents are keeping their kids inside more these days. Some of that is a growing fear of nature itself, as your caller says. But I think that that is associated also with the fear of strangers, human beings. The truth is when you look at stranger danger, for instance, the number of abductions of children by strangers, it's actually relatively quite low, that the vast number of abductions of children are by someone the family knows or a family member. And that the overall number has actually been going down for about 20 years. And if that's true, why do we feel more and more fear? And I think all you have to do is watch CNN or Fox, and you'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children and repeat them over and over and over again. A slow news week, they go find JonBenet Ramsey again. They repeat that over and over and over again. When I say they, I mean we. Newspapers do it too. And it is, you know, we're not doing our job as journalists when we do that, because our job is to portray the world as close as we humanly can to the way it actually is. And when every local crime becomes a national crime in terms of children, then we're not painting an accurate picture of how our neighborhoods actually are. And that creates more fear, which ironically creates more danger, because when you take good people off the street and out of the parks and out of the woods, then you've left them open for bad people to go into. That's a basic policing principle. This community policing is based on getting more good people into parks and out on the street, eyes on the park, et cetera. So we really have to question ourselves in the news media as to what we're doing in terms of painting an accurate picture and what that means. Now, the second thing I would say about this is that I'm not saying that there isn't danger out there. There's danger from strange humans. There's also danger from nature itself. I know because my son and I went fishing on Kodiak two summers in a row, and we had a great time with bears, and we were not unafraid of them. And
I don't reckon you weren't.
No, and it was wonderful being there, partly because, you know, the human organism is very attracted to nature. That's one of the reasons why this is so important. But we do need to begin to think and report in terms of comparative risk.
Yeah. For instance, it took us forever. In the news media, we got all swept up in this child abduction thing for years. It took us years to figure out that it was mostly custody disputes. And once we had reported it, you know, we didn't feel like we needed to report it when the next child abduction took place, because we'd already said it. And so we get trapped in our own conventions.
Well, however, I have a 6-year-old.
We started out talking about child obesity.
Yeah.
If we want a real risk, we'll look at that. Pediatricians are now saying that this generation of children may be the first to have a lower life expectancy than their own parents in our history. That's a real risk. How often does that get reported compared to, you know, JonBenet Ramsey? That's the question we have to ask.
George, are you still with us there from Anchorage?
No, I have been a teacher, and I agree with so much of what your guest is saying today, because I've noticed that with my students, and I always made an effort to get them out in the woods and get them on their bicycles and go for, you know, field trips in the woods. And one of the things was really wonderful at our school was how the ski club here donated skis to our school to be used for a month or so in the wintertime to get kids out and skiing. Kids who've never had skis before, and the large majority of the students at our school, because it's in a poor neighborhood, had never been skiing before, and they loved it. It was a life recreation kind of activity they could do. It was non-competitive, it was fun, and the school is just a few blocks from one of the largest parks in our town, and yet most of the kids don't take advantage of it. So
Parks and Recreation plays a big role in that program, and we are always looking for volunteers to help us make some of those successful. Volunteers, we want your time, we want your money, we want your old skis, the whole ball of wax. But there are all kinds of programs we can get people involved in, and those are really important when you're looking at people that maybe their parents don't ski, and how are children in Anchorage in this winter city going to get exposed to winter outdoor activities without some of these structured programs in the schools and outs?
And it's so much easier for kids to learn to ski than it is for adults.
And so many people here come from the lower 48 and aren't exposed to having a winter where it's snowy all the time.
Yeah.
Or their parents have three jobs, and how is it going to work?
Yeah, exactly.
George, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Beth, you wanted to chime in on this. There's danger out there, as you...
Well, I think the stranger danger and the bear danger are very large, and I don't know...
Well, not to mention the moose danger, which is what I have in my neighborhood.
That's right. Well, you know, I have a six-year-old, and I just can't imagine that I'm going to send her out the door one day and say, don't come home until dinner, honey. And that is what people of your generation used to do. So we have changed, and we have changed... Maybe. I don't know how we buck that tide, but I can tell you that I do have hope in our community, this community of Anchorage, where we celebrate and revere the big wildlife. This is who we are, right? We have so much public lands in our community, and then we are surrounded by wilderness. Now, the other thing that Anchorage has, and we're a pretty relatively good-sized community, 260,000 or so, we probably have the highest concentration of natural resource agencies in the world right here in our city. We've got the BLM, we've got the Chugach National Forest, we've got the National Wildlife Federation. The national parks, we have all of the resources. And if we pool our resources together, we should be able to make a difference here. And I think Anchorage has a real opportunity to do something shining and cool.
And that's part of one of the reasons for the summits, right, is that nobody really has that much money, so...
We've got to pool our resources, right. Definitely.
A really good point. Richard, I want to go to this this thought that I opened the show with, that Anchorage and Alaska is not really the last frontier anymore, because you speak of several frontiers, a succession of frontiers, including a new one that is just opening up now, which really has to do with this relationship with nature, even in urbanized places. And I wanted to give you a chance to expound on that.
Right. The progression of frontiers that I describe in Last Child in the Woods, or kind of the first frontier, which still exists in some places. I mean, it still exists in parts of Alaska, which, you know, really is, you know, it's kind of the Davy Crockett frontier we imagine. The second frontier would be the Teddy Roosevelt period up until, the 1950s, in which 1940s and 1950s, in which the first frontier, the real one, was romanticized, and yet we still went outside. We still went outside and kind of imagined that we were Davy Crockett, and we played in the woods, and we grew up in that way.
And that would be like Boy Scouts and that sort of thing would come up out there.
That's right. The third frontier is the one we're in now. And the third frontier is in which we've gone indoors, and that the value we place on nature has been diminished remarkably. And we're almost to the point in which we're not even sure what life is, period, because of nanotechnology, and, you know, we're now cloning, you know, creating... There's actually a mouse that they grew a human ear on. It's not a real human ear, but it is. This is some years ago. So we're really kind of confused now as to what nature is. I think that the fourth frontier is the one we're about to enter or can choose to enter. And that's the frontier in which we reclaim the importance of nature to our health, to our children, to our mental health, and that we begin to, in essence, create nature. And that's contradictory. But if we look at our cities in a different way and begin to imagine more nature, even in the places where there are more people living. In Western Europe, they're building these eco-villages in which there is both higher human density, but also there is more natural habitat. By nature, natural habitat, I'm describing green roofs that attract...
So you're not talking about it. It's so weird. You fly over Manhattan Island and you see Olmsted's magnificent park right in the center of it, and you say, wow, isn't this something? And you go in and you walk around it, and you say, wow, what an amazing accomplishment this is. That's not what you're talking about.
Actually,
you're talking about something more indigenous to you know, like Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, that is open to the wilder nature around it?
Well, it's both. I mean, Central Park is actually a good example, because Central Park was built by the industrialists in New York, not because it would be pretty, but because the industrialists understood that the health of their workers depended on them getting outside into something like nature. And that's where that came from. And we've forgotten that lesson in urban planning, but it's coming back.
Yeah, so but I mean, you take your own town of, like, San Diego. There's lately an effort to, like, not have people have grass lawns, for instance, but have things that are more indigenous to your actual biome.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But also to protect the canyons here in San Diego, something I fought for a long time as a columnist that go through the urban areas, to really recognize that we can increase the amount of nature. And again, I'm defining nature in a broad way. In our lives, and that will increase our health, it'll increase our mental health, it'll increase our children's ability to learn, it'll decrease the symptoms of attention deficit disorder in children and in adults, it lowers stress. The more we can do that, the better off humans are. And in fact, what we're really talking about goes beyond just the restoration of nature. We're talking about a kind of creation of nature where there hasn't been nature in a while. And ultimately, we're talking about human restoration. That's a different way to look at the environment.
Thank you. Richard Louv is our guest, the author of Last Child in the Woods. And Richard has a website, www.childrenandnature.org. And one thing I think that is important about your book, of many things, is that you have, in this new edition of the book, put more examples in there, and I think probably that the sheer mass of the examples you've found of this this new frontier you're talking about can really kind of blow people's minds.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. At the end of it are 100 actions that people can take. Half of them are focused on families, such as creating a family nature club where you get together with other families to agree to show up at the park on Saturday or go fishing or do something else outside. That's something we're hoping catches on.
I love that.
And in fact, that came about because of a second grade teacher and father in Roanoke, Virginia, who read the book and decided that his family was going to get outside more. They started having family adventures in nature on weekends. One day the five-year-old turns to the father and says, "Dad, how come we're the only family having this much fun?" So he started inviting other families. Before he knew it, he had 170 families on his email list. And what these families are doing is arranging essentially nature play dates on weekends for the whole family, so that 1, 2, 4, 5, 6 families get together. They agree to get together. This deals with the fear issue, because there's perceived safety in number.
And also, you know, the cultural issue, because more and more I'm realizing we think we can't do things like this.
That's
we think
right.
There's something illegal about it or something.
That's right. And any kind of family can do it, any kind of neighborhood. And guess what? You don't have to wait for funding. And in the end, one of the benefits of this, particularly as parks begin to encourage families to create their own family nature clubs with other families, that creates a constituency for parks, for the programs, both politically and socially. You'll fill up your programs that connect kids to nature if you encourage parents to create their own family nature clubs with other parents on their own without waiting for funding. That's one of the things we're hoping happens and moves into true cultural change.
Wow. Let's go to Gregory, joins the program from Dillingham. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Gregory. Hello, Gregory. Still there?
Yes. Richard, I'm going to have to chime in exactly what you said. It's something about fishing by hook, spear, net, or hunting with a gun. It's really not for the kill or anything. It's for the experience that I truly love. And I was so lucky that my dad took me out there to get my feet wet, so I never did get that fear for all the many, many hours I've spent out there in my older life. But it's kind of like when somebody asks me, "Did you go to church today?" I said, "Yeah, I've been out there camping for a week. For me, Mother Nature is my church." It's something something that I'm surely addicted to. Somehow words cannot capture the moment and the experience. But, however, that water and that land is just so powerful source of energy. Now to go fishing is a benefit in hunting, kind of quadruples the experience. And it's kind of mysterious and not knowing what will happen in a split second. An animal jump out, a fish on your hook. I'm not really hunting particularly on the land or the water for something to gain, but seeking something unknown within me. Something I'm lacking, something I'm missing. It's like a spiritual experience.
Gregory, thank you so much. It's great to hear from Bristol Bay, Gregory. Thank you so much for your call. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
Let's see if we can whip through a few of these calls here. Beth joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Beth.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very good.
Well, I just wanted to call and say here in Juneau, I'm the director for an organization called Discovery Southeast, and we've been doing hands-on nature education programs for 20 years now. This is our 20th anniversary. And it's interesting how we sort of came about. The guiding industry here, one of the guiding organizations, the guides said, oh, all these people are coming from all over the world having amazing interactions with nature in this great place that we live in. But the local people don't have the same opportunities. So
the Beth sitting across from me who grew up in Juneau is nodding her head.
Yeah, and so we have this great opportunity now to be able to connect the local people here to nature, and we do this primarily through our programs. Nature studies is something we've been doing in the third, fourth, and fifth grades, taking kids out three times a year on hikes to explore their very own backyards and the places that they can go back to that are near their homes and near where they're going to school, because we've found that, you know, kids who live across the street from the Tongass National Forest and the Mendenhall Glacier, you know, recreation area, have never been across the street to discover that.
Wow. Beth, thank you so much for your call.
Sure.
Let's go to Judy. Joins the program from Gustavus. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Judy.
Thanks. Oh, I'm so glad somebody called in from Discovery Southeast. I just want to put out the importance of kids having useful, appropriate clothes in Alaska.
Oh, yes, a very Alaskan comment.
Yeah.
You can never have too much gear in Alaska.
I know. It's hard keeping kids in rubber boots and other, you know, rain gear and stuff because they're growing. And but here's an example. Some years ago, I worked for a little while for Big Brothers Big Sisters in Juneau, and the Bigs wanted to take the kids outdoors and do outdoor activities. And very often a barrier was that they didn't have rubber boots or rain gear and so forth. And I don't know. I know, I get a lot of times kids don't even want to wear those things. That's true. But how to make that more available since it's so expensive? Maybe the secondhand stores like St. Vincent de Paul's and Salvation could concentrate on getting more children's foot gear, especially, and they could you can sanitize it. And yeah. That would just be one suggestion.
I think that's great. That's a good idea for the summit, the boot swap. So thanks for helping Anchorage with their ideas there, Judy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Chris, joins the program from Wasilla, Alaska. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris. Everybody knows where Wasilla is now.
I guess they do. Well, we won't go into that, will we? Listen, I just want to, number one, thank the author for writing this incredible book because it was a catalyst for a wonderful, wonderful, very needed movement in this nation, and that is No Child Left Inside. He was talking previously about the bill that passed the Congress. I basically...
Just the House. It hasn't passed the Senate.
Right. Just the House. Yeah. At any rate, we have out here in the Valley an organization called Alaskans for Palmer Hayflats. And this actually is a conservation organization that got together and decided that the Palmer Hay Flats, which so many people just zip by through going 60 miles an hour on the freeway, have no clue what's really here. It's a tremendous resource for education, for awareness, for recreation all seasons of the year. So our first...
You mean not just duck season?
Oh, good Lord, no. all four seasons.
All right.
At any rate, after we have pretty much cleaned it up now, and after decades of abuse and underfunding and neglect for so many years, we also are we sponsor programs throughout for every season of the year for folks to get out onto this refuge, which is right on the road system.
Oh, good. It's good to know.
Back door. And but in addition to that, after we have been so project-oriented this first 3 years of our existence, our next and most important long-term contribution towards community stewardship and, you know, as I was explaining when I first signed on for this call, what I term as establishing a conservation ethos in our area and certainly in our state and particularly, of course, in this refuge, in this community.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Go ahead.
An education center, a natural science education community center. So we don't have a facility yet. Of course, we're going to the legislature for funding. But it was really, this was kicked off as and recognized as a true need, due in no small part to Richard's book and The No Child Left Inside. On our website, for example, we have embedded The No Child Left Inside little videos, about 7 or 8 minutes long.
All right, Chris.
Incredibly powerful.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Nellie Moore just sent one saying, parents, grandparents, it's time to get dirty. You don't need a 4,000 bike to get the kids going. Collect some pieces of wood, build a fort, make a jump, weave some grass, cook a meal of mud pies, show your brain still functions at a very creative level in the environment. Thanks, Nellie. Richard Louvre, you've got the last word here, but it's only about 30 seconds worth.
Okay. Well, first, you know, there's actually a national toy hall of fame, and and the stick, just a few weeks ago, the stick was inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame, so I know we're making progress. And I'd just like to say that I hope Alaska leads the nation.
I think we will.
You have so much potential there to really, as Beth has said, as many of the callers have said, to really show the rest of the nation how to reclaim nature as part of our lives. It's still there in Alaska, so you have a head start on many of us.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us. Look forward to your next book. Richard Louvre, author of Last Child in the Woods. Beth Nordland, Parks and Rec, thanks a lot.
Get outdoors, Anchorage.
All right. Gooseberry Peter at the controls. Duncan Moon's our managing editor. And it's Lynn Anderson on the phones. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Spinard Builder Supply, celebrating 56 years of supplying the building materials to help you build Alaska with 21 statewide locations.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.